Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
President Kennedy, Dr. King, and Attorney General Robert Kennedy were drawn together by history and by the crisis of racism that gripped America in the 1960s. At first, the Kennedys and Dr. King were not natural partners, but their interactions eventually became a central part of the Civil Rights Revolution. Dr. King always led the way. In his first meeting with President Kennedy in the White House, he issued a challenge. "Mr. President," he said, "I'd like to see you stand in this room and sign a second Emancipation Proclamation outlawing segregation." In June 1963, the president responded by sending a civil rights bill to the Congress and proclaiming that, and I quote, "In this year of the Emancipation Centennial, justice requires us to ensure the blessings of liberty for all Americans and their posterity." 3 long years later, in a speech to the National Union of South African Students, Robert Kennedy issued his own challenge in stirring words that could have applied equally to Dr. King, to his brother, and to himself. He told the students that, and I quote, "Each time a man stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and injustice." Now, the story behind those historic speeches is the story we will hear today. It's dramatic and often painful, just as the relationship between the Kennedys and Dr. King was complex and sometimes clashing. But in the end, history has marked them as powerful allies in the battle for equality of opportunity. We will divide our conference today into 2 sessions. The first will look closely at the years 1960 to 63, when King challenged the Kennedy administration to take up the cause of civil rights, and President Kennedy responded. The second session will focus on the years 1963 to 68, at the height of the civil rights movement and during the growing U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Each session will conclude with an opportunity for questions from the audience, and we will take a very brief break between the 2 sessions. Now, it's difficult to imagine a more dazzling array of speakers than those who have come to the Kennedy Library this afternoon to lead us into the world of JFK, MLK, and RFK. Ted Sorensen, to my immediate left, by his very presence and even more so by his eloquence, links the legacy of John F. Kennedy to the challenges of our own time. For 11 years, from 1954 to 1963, he served as policy advisor, legal counsel, and speechwriter to Senator and then President Kennedy. He was deeply involved in every presidential decision on the great issues of the day, from the Cuban Missile Crisis to the framing of the nation's civil rights legislation to the decision to go to the moon. And he worked tirelessly at the president's side through all the moments of his time in office. And when it was over, he wrote the 1965 book, Kennedy, which became an international bestseller and remains the standard against which other studies of the Kennedy presidency are measured. And over the last 4 decades, Ted Sorensen has had a distinguished career in law and international affairs. Harris Wofford, next to Ted Sorensen, was a central figure in formulating the Kennedy administration's civil rights policies. He served as chairman of the president's sub-cabinet group on civil rights from 1960 to 62, arranging meetings with civil rights leaders and helping frame the administration's position on civil rights legislation. He later assisted in the formation of the Peace Corps and became its associate director and special representative to Africa. His 1980 book of Kennedys and Kings provides an insider's view of the interactions between the Kennedy brothers and Dr. King during the period we're exploring here today. He later served as a U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania and as CEO of the Corporation for National and Community Service. Bob Moses was a legendary organizer in the civil rights movement. In many people's minds, the true central hero from the field in that movement. As field secretary of the Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee, Bob recruited and trained thousands of young volunteers to work on voter registration in Mississippi in the early 1960s. In 1962, he helped found the Council of Federated Organizations to promote collaboration among competing civil rights groups. Then in 1964, he mobilized the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project and nurtured the development of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which challenged the Democratic Party regulars at the 1964 Democratic National Convention. For many years, Bob Moses has also been at the forefront of efforts to promote literacy in math through his famous Algebra Project, which works with underserved students in schools across the country. Our final speaker, who will also be our moderator and discussion leader in this session, is Taylor Branch. Taylor is one of our nation's foremost authorities on the civil rights movement and the biography of the man who stood at its center, Martin Luther King, Jr. He has just completed the third volume of his monumental King trilogy, Canaan at the Edge, covering the years 1965 to 1968, and it will be published this winter. His first volume, Parting the Waters, dealt with the years 1954 to 63 and won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. A second volume, Pillar of Fire, covering 1963 to 1965, was published to enormous critical acclaim in 1998. Taylor became fascinated by the living legacy of Martin Luther King when he was a student in the mid-1960s at the University of North Carolina. He's the author of two novels and several other books about the struggle for civil rights and human rights, and he's been a friend and advisor to President Clinton and was involved in the preparation of Clinton's first inaugural address. So please join me in welcoming to the stage of the Kennedy Library Ted Sorensen, Harris Wofford, Bob Moses, and Taylor Branch.
Thank you. We want to try to move rapidly. Obviously, we can only skim over topics that we've all written books about, and there are jillions of stories. And we want to get to questions from you by 3 o'clock. So we can only try to give some a gist of and a reaction and a few hints of the complexities of this era. And I want to do that by asking for opening comments kind of in order from my fellow panelists. And then we'll engage in conversation for a while and then bring you into it at 3 o'clock. Ted, we want to start with you to try to take us back to 1960, the 60 campaign. It is a common judgment of history that President Kennedy's call to Coretta King, that one simple gesture, shifted enough black votes in certain key states to have determined the outcome of the 60 election. Whether or not that's true, the fact of the matter is that civil rights was already a large issue in a campaign that was dominated by the Cold War. So what I really want to ask you is, coming into office and through the campaign, as President Kennedy's gifted speechwriter and wordsmith, kind of crafting how you were going to present yourself, What do you remember as the place of civil rights in the overall campaign that was dominated by competition with the Soviet Union? In other words, when on the inauguration day, where did Martin Luther King and where did the civil rights movement more generally fit in your minds?
Thanks very much, Taylor. Let me first just explain about not being able to see you when you're looking at me, but I may have said this hall before, folks, don't worry about my lack of effective eyesight. I have more vision than the President of the United States. In any event, I should let me set the context for the 1960 campaign. By that time, I had been with John F. Kennedy since he became a senator in January of 1953. And having had a substantial involvement in civil rights as a boy growing up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and in college, and even slightly in my previous jobs in Washington, D.C. I, frankly, was frustrated by his lack of deep interest and involvement in that issue. He was a Democratic senator. He had been a Democratic congressman. He voted right on civil rights measures. But it was not a high priority with him. It was not a problem that he knew very much about, having grown up far from the inner cities of Boston and the United States in general. But as a man who had a deep conscience, he knew which was the right side of that issue. As a man who had been a member of a family and nationality and religion that had been subject to discrimination, he understood the slings and arrows of prejudice and discrimination, and to that extent could identify with other victims of those same slings and arrows. And he also knew that the African-American community was an important part of the Democratic Party constituency, and he would talk about the issue in his speeches, and even had the courage when his informal campaign began, which in many ways was right after the 1956 Democratic National Convention. We spent the next 3.5-4 years traveling to every state in the country, and that included some states of the South, where he was courageous enough to point out that he did not vary his position on civil rights from North to South, from white audiences to black audiences. And as we began the early primaries and other searches for delegates and voters in 1960, we had black Americans as part of our campaign team in many parts of the country. I can tell you some specific ones in D.C., in Milwaukee, in Chicago, and elsewhere. And then on the week of the convention in July 1960, which was held in Los Angeles, there was also, perhaps to put pressure on the party, that's okay, the NAACP had a massive rally, not their annual convention, but a massive rally in Los Angeles, where the Democratic Convention was being held, and John F. Kennedy spoke at that convention, and he spoke out. Now, here again, one should point out, we knew the election, if Kennedy were the nominee, was going to be very, very close. He was running against an incumbent Republican administration and its vice president. And the Southern Democrats, who were very upset about the Democratic platform, which had pro-civil rights planks in it, the Southern Democrats were vowing a new strategy under which they would, in several states, vote not for the Democratic electors, but so-called independent electors, which they would hold back and decide whether the Democratic or Republican nominee offered them the best deal on their antagonism to civil rights. And if they didn't like what the Democrat had to say, they would throw those independent electors to the Republican nominee, guaranteeing his election in the Electoral College, regardless of how the vote might otherwise have come up. Despite that, despite the knowledge that antagonizing the South on civil rights could cost him the election, Kennedy gave the major, or at least one of the major addresses at that NAACP rally in Los Angeles, and went all out talking about the need to end forever second-class citizenship based on race in the country's leading democracy. He also insisted that the platform of the Democratic Party, over which he had some control even before he became the nominee, stick to its guns on civil rights. And during the campaign, He spoke out in South Carolina and other southern states, as well as in Detroit and New York, emphasizing that it was time for America to face squarely the civil rights issue that had not really been addressed since the days of Abraham Lincoln. When he stood on the inaugural platform on that cold day, January 20, 1961, he had, and as Harris knows very well, he had made a last-minute, last-day change in his inaugural address to tell the world, North, South, Black, White, that we were committed to the same human rights that our forefathers had fought for, and we were committed to prevent their slow erosion at home as well as around the world. He found when he was in office that his political margins were so small, having lost 20 seats in the House of Representatives, partly due to fallen away Democrats who did not like a Catholic at the head of the ticket, that he had to proceed with care in terms of executive orders and in terms of legislation that he sent to Congress. And the frustrations that I and others, including Harris, had with the pace of progress on civil rights continued, perhaps even mounted, although some more measures were taken in 1962, and then as pressure built in 1963, it became absolutely necessary for him to address the issue in a way no president had ever addressed it before, and that came first with the implementation of the court order declaring that James Meredith must be admitted to the University of Mississippi, no matter how many rioters and protesters gathered to keep him out, and that was September 30, 1962, just weeks before the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then in the spring of 1963, as the fires burned even hotter throughout the South, but to a substantial extent in the country as a whole, and he made certain that George Wallace would not stand in the doorway of the University of Alabama and block the admission of two students. He decided very quickly on addressing the nation on that subject that very evening, June 11. Sorry for the long answer.
Thank you. We do want to come back to June 11th before the end of this panel. Harris, we'd like to jump forward to you. In my view, Harris was about 50 years ahead of his time in a number of respects coming into the Kennedy administration on this particular issue. There were very few Gandhians who had been to India and practiced nonviolence even before the nonviolent movement got started in civil rights to a large degree, and very few Yale graduates went to Black law school at Howard University. Harris did both those things and was kind of the civil rights specialist within the Kennedy campaign in a different era, committed to civil rights, as Ted has said, and yet at the same time, I think you told me years ago, Harris, that it was a different era. It was when the Black vote was kind of taken for granted as the minority vote, and Bill Dawson, the machine congressman from Chicago, was the minority affairs guy. And I think you said that his office was, everybody called it Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was in the back, and nobody paid any attention to him. So it's a really transitional era. Harris is trying to push the administration to fulfill what he knows that they know is right. So, Harris, I'd like to just, from your point of view, the inspiration and frustration of that time as the person coming into office as the point person for the administration on this historic and sensitive issue.
Taylor, we're sitting here and you're watching somebody I consider a real heir of Mahatma Gandhi, Bob Moses, who represented not only the direct action side of Gandhi that Martin Luther King most of all is remembered for, but the constructive service side that Gandhi and King both said was the hardest part of the Gandhi idea, the two sides of the coin, the social invention and steady work, not the dramatic marches and the rest. I want to add one other preliminary point, which is that I was not at all disturbed that John Kennedy in the early years was not deeply involved and had not been involved in civil rights. I actually became a supporter of John Kennedy in 1957 because of two major speeches on a new view of the world reflected in test cases of Poland and Algeria that Ted Sorensen had a major role in writing. I wrote him that they were the two best speeches that I'd heard on foreign policy in my day in the Congress of the United States. And I did it because the senior partner in the firm I was in, Covington & Burling, had publicly said those were the irresponsible utterings of a juvenile senator, or a juvenile senator's irresponsible, juvenile remarks by an irresponsible senator. Kennedy was asked, are you, from the time he wrote While England Slept through the time of his death, I think John Kennedy conveyed that the world was the question, the world was the stage, and he had a vision of the world, which the inaugural address gave to us, and a vision of citizen service and citizen action in the ask not, but what to ask phrase. And I never had any doubt from my dealings with him when I, from 57 on, when we did speech on African ambassadors in this country in 58 or 59, that I'd helped work on, that he was not only open on this issue, but that he was ready. He was asked, are you a liberal or a conservative? And he said, I hope I'm responsible in the active sense of the word respond to the facts as they are. And he faced some facts right away, and so did the Attorney General. They faced the fact of Eisenhower having said nothing about the desegregation decision of Brown versus Board, or the later applications of that principle. He told his wife that he had not even told, he told the press that he had not even told his wife what he thought about that decision, instead of giving leadership, moral or otherwise, to help make that decision work. And so in the very first weeks of the administration, there was a Supreme Court opinion saying that in interstate bus transportation, racial segregation was unconstitutional. And the Attorney General got drawn into that for issues of law and order. The Freedom Riders rode about a week or two after that decision to test it. It was not pleasing to John Kennedy, conveyed to me, get your friends off those buses. You know, we're going to a meeting with Khrushchev. We have crucial decisions. There, I think, had before that already been the Bay of Pigs, or it was about to come. The agenda was not ready for the Freedom Riders, but when they rode and when they were attacked, the Attorney General, in all out ways in due course, saw that the buses got through. You know some of the legends about that. The response for people that were riding the buses was slow by a few days, but the response in the end rapidly was massive. And then beyond that, the decision was made that we're going to see that within a year there is the end of segregation in every bus and railroad station in the South. And the Justice Department went into the Federal Transportation Interstate, which commission was it?
Interstate Commerce Commission,
and pursued it and had photographs taken. It's one of the few things they could get the FBI to do, as I recall. They photographed what was there, and a year later, some of the Freedom Riders were asked to go back, and in a year, segregation had ended. So I landed in the White House with an Attorney General that was going to be the a point person with the central responsibility and power, with an extraordinarily wise Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, who was a close friend of mine. My job was to try to be a coordinator and facilitator and advisor on all of this. We had a sub-cabinet group on civil rights of cabinet-level people, assistants, secretaries, actually meeting from the Defense Department to the Education Welfare Department. It was quite an extraordinary group that was not in a secret plot, but was in an open conspiracy to try to help Kennedy move the civil rights agenda as far as it could be moved, and to do it recognizing the facts that of the margin in the House and the Congress and the coming election for Congress, recognizing the facts, what could you do? And that takes me back to the thing that led to my being shifted from being a speechwriter assistant to TED, which I came to do in the spring of 1960, to the civil rights assignment. Kennedy picked me up on the sidewalk one day. He had learned that I had been working with Martin Luther King in the 50s from the bus boycott on. And he said, all right, something like in 10 minutes, tick off the 5 things, or 5 minutes, tick off the 10 things that I ought to do to clean up the damn civil rights mess. And I had my chance, and I gave him the thesis of executive action was something that could be done on a really large and creative scale if a president was committed to it, beginning with one stroke of the pen, could sign the executive order against discrimination in federally assisted housing. It had been drafted in the Civil Rights Commission with Father Hesburgh and others of us working there, been on Eisenhower's desk for a year and a half, unsigned. And he loved it. One stroke of a pen, he said. And then he liked the other examples of executive action that this sub-cabinet group on civil rights was going to do, not only in terms of affirmative action, employment, but in terms of facilities and whatever it was that the Defense Department or the Education Department or the other great departments of the government could do to advance the rights of minorities in this country, and then particularly focused on blacks. And of course, I got in a little trouble later because it turns out there were both legal and major political obstacles to executive action. It wasn't as simple as I had sort of conveyed, that congressmen that needed to be reelected for the Kennedy program to get through Congress said, if you sign that order, we're going to be beaten. And it was about to be signed, and Kennedy called me on the phone, said we've decided to delay it because of this, that reason, which were quite clear reasons. I was very disappointed on that particular score, and I paid the price of being disappointed because the civil rights movement picked up the theme that it was being not signed despite the first debate with Nixon, Kennedy having said, with one stroke of a pen, I'm going to sign that civil rights executive order. So they had a campaign to send pens saying one stroke of a pen to the president. And when a huge batch of them came in, apparently, allegedly he said, send them over to Harris. He's the one that got me into that. When I left to go to Africa, I had a backlog of an agenda that I had every confidence that he wanted to achieve all the things that were in the Democratic platform of 1960. The strongest platform that had ever been adopted by the Democratic Party. I didn't have any doubt what he wanted to do, but I had urged him to get an African American of outstanding quality into the spot I was in so that I could go to Africa with my family and the Peace Corps and be a civil rights man in Africa for the larger integration of the world of the white minority in a largely colored world. And I gave him a memorandum of the agenda to be followed, and I had my last meeting with him, and he went down every one of the items and said, we're going to do it. I have to wait a while on this, I have to wait a while on that, but you'll see we're going to do it. And he did. By the time he was killed, he had moved forward, including calling for legislation that he was also waited carefully. I would say, in a way, the way Lincoln waited when he signed to sign the Emancipation Proclamation to a time he thought it could work. He did it before he was killed. The Attorney General, not only before he was killed, but right away, as Burke Marshall once said, on his learning curve on civil rights, Burke said it began at Crown Zero, and the graph went on up and up. And before he was killed, he had been transformed on this issue and on the issue of peace and of poverty in a way no one other than Martin Luther King in our public life was. So it was quite a ride. It was a I was asked during my Senate campaign by a writer, how lucky you were. You worked with John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. And I shot back, some luck. They were all killed. And that sour answer I heard after she had left, and I said, I don't want to be printed that way. And we tracked her down, and I said, please don't print that remark. We were lucky. We were so very, very lucky. And I feel lucky today to be with these colleagues and with you.
Thank you, Harris. Thank you. Now, people of good instincts on a world stage are coming in and colliding with politics from the administration side. The civil rights movement is doing the same thing. I think before, I just want to say a couple of words in introducing Bob. Dr. King was not in favor of the sit-ins or the Freedom Rides. Dr. King thought he could preach America out of segregation, and he spent the late 1950s trying to do that. His model was Billy Graham, believe it or not, and they collaborated secretly to convert America from segregation. It didn't work. His distinctive quality was that when the sit-ins started, he paid tribute. He was the only major civil rights leader to pay tribute to students for making real something that he knew but didn't want to accept, which is that words alone are not enough in certain areas. It requires sacrifice, political witness, which is what the Freedom Rides and the sit-ins were. He held back from both. He did go to jail in the sit-in right before the 1960 election, which played, as we discussed earlier, a pivotal role in that election. The Freedom Rides the next year, he didn't go, and the students got up in his face saying, where is your body? You should get on the bus. And he didn't. There was tremendous controversy from both sides about the civil rights movement. Dr. King said, I should choose the time of my own martyrdom, because he had already been under death threats and for years. The Kennedy administration, at the end of the Freedom Rides, put out an offer that divided the civil rights movement, or the young students who had been the leaders of the sit-ins in the Freedom Rides, offering, if you'll stop riding these buses, which causes all this uproar and international political turmoil, we'll help you get grants to register voters, and that's long-run political change. And there was a tremendous upheaval among the students between whether this was essentially a sellout, meaning that the administration wanted to get them off the streets making trouble and registering voters to vote for them, that didn't make any sense. And other people said these demonstrations are, and the Freedom Rides are bombastic and they get a lot of publicity, but long-run political change is voting and voting rights and registering people to vote. Bob Moses came into the civil rights era in 1960, his first trip south as a graduate student and teacher, but he went back to live in Mississippi the next year in a way kind of a loner, separate from this debate going on among his peers, the young students, as to whether voter registration was a retreat from direct action and political involvement or was a more sophisticated long-run strategy for the same thing. And he was in Mississippi by himself and within a few weeks became a legend among these very same students because he essentially eclipsed all of the differences. Voter registration was direct action. You would have demonstrations and pay consequences for trying to register voters in the South just as you would getting on a bus for the Freedom Rides. So his contact with the Kennedy government that is now in was through voter registration beginning in the summer of 1961. So I'd now like to have Bob tell you a little bit about what it was like to deal with the government from this and the movement
from the standpoint of being a pioneer in voter registration in Mississippi in the summer of 1961. Bob?
How's everybody? Good. Taylor, do you mind if I...
revise my remarks?
No. Get off the script just a little bit.
No.
From that. Okay. And I can say, with respect to what Taylor just said, that when Billy Jack Caston went upside my head in Liberty, the SNCC people thought that was pretty direct. And so the whole issue about whether voter registration was also direct action dissipated. It wasn't an issue. I would like to actually lay out a framework that I'm struggling with as part of the work that I currently do with the Algebra Project. And I teach math at Lanier High School in Jackson, Mississippi. This is my 10th year working there as part of the Algebra Project. We are struggling with some big issues that I want to tie into the issues that we're talking about on the panel. And I want to read from a book that Burke edited called A Workable Government. And the quote is from Justice Robert Jackson. And he says, "The actual art of governing under our Constitution does not and cannot conform to judicial definitions of the power of any of its branches based on isolated clauses or even single articles torn from context. While the Constitution diffuses power the better to secure liberty, it also contemplates that practice will integrate the dispersed powers into a workable government." And then Burke goes on to say that surely matters of structure and government institutions were a principal, if not primary, concern of the framers in 1787, and should be such for the people of the United States today. The question still is whether the Constitution integrates the dispersed powers it disposes, not just within the federal government, but also among the nation and the states, into a workable government for the end of the 20th century and on into the 21st century. So when Burke Marshall passed a couple of summers ago, John Doerr, as you know, who was his right-hand man in the field, asked me if I would come up to the memorial that they held at the Yale, I think it's the Yale, what do you call it, the Yale Club, I guess, in New York City. And a number of people spoke there. He wanted me to meet Burke's family. And so I did. And then they asked me if I would speak at the memorial they were going to hold that following fall at Yale University. And I did, agreed to speak. And so then I decided, well, I need to look up some of the things that Burke wrote about. And so Burke wrote he published a little book that were based on lectures that he had given at Columbia Law School in the spring of 64, right? And this is right after the assassination, right before the Summer Project. And he published those in a work that's called Federalism and Civil Rights. And Attorney General Bobby Kennedy wrote the foreword. And so in the foreword, Bobby Kennedy says that one of the most difficult problems the Department of Justice has had to face during the past 3.5 years is how to explain the apparent anomaly of having sent marshals and soldiers to Oxford, Mississippi in September 62 and not having done this so during the civil rights crisis in Birmingham in May of 63. of having sent marshals to Montgomery, Alabama in May 61, when the Freedom Riders were beaten, but not to Mississippi in the summer of 64, as violence over racial matters increased and the three young civil rights workers disappeared. And then he says, talks in general about this issue of a workable government. He says, our forefathers devised a system of checks and balances. They were concerned lest too much power be placed in the hands of one group within the federal government. Therefore, they divided the government into three separate branches, the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary, as a check on all three branches as a whole. They left considerable powers to the states as separate entities. One of these powers was responsibility for maintaining law and order. And then Burke, in his work in this book, right, he takes up the issue and goes on and says that this issue of federalism, right, the states versus the federal government, which is, of course, this is the whole issue, dealing with the Freedom Rides and dealing with the right to vote, dealing with Meredith at Ole Miss and so forth, Governor Ross Barnett and the idea of nullification. He says, Burke says, this system of federalism has been protected thus far since the mid-1870s by non-recognition of federally guaranteed rights. It's an amazing statement to me that what has protected the workable government is that there's non-recognition of federal guaranteed rights. Right? So what Burke does, and let me just say that in the work of the Alger Project, what we've begun to ask for is a constitutional amendment, that the country needs to revisit its constitution and think about amending the constitution to guarantee a quality public school education for every child in the country, that the country needs to think that every child that lives in the country is a child of the country. And of course, the civil rights movement was about thinking about black children for the first time as really children of the country. And we didn't quite get all the way there, as Katrina showed us most recently. And when I went to look at what Burke had written, he sent me back. He was the one that actually, in his writing, got me to thinking that this is what we need, a constitutional amendment. Because what he did in his conclusion, let me see if I can find it. Hold with me here a second. In the conclusion of his book, he talks about, I'll have to find it. Oh, here we go. What he's saying is that in 1883, the Supreme Court of the United States held the Civil Rights Act of 1875 to be beyond the power of Congress to enact. Now, in 1875, and my reading this sent me back to look at that, Ulysses S. Grant was president. And in 1875, he proposed to Congress that the country should amend the Constitution and guarantee to the freed slaves a public school education, that the country should take on the responsibility of making sure that the freed slaves got an education. Congress couldn't think of that, so they didn't act on that suggestion. But that same Congress passed the country's first Civil Rights Act in 1875, the rights that we finally got in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But in 1883, Burke says that the Supreme Court said that Congress didn't have the right to do that. And Justice Harlan was the only justice that dissented from that, right? And what Burke here is saying is that this set up the situation for Jim Crow and what we were facing back down in Mississippi in the 1960s. So I just want to throw out on the table that the history is present with us now, and the issues that the Kennedy administration was facing, which is certainly the issue of, as the other speakers mentioned, how are we going to have a workable government that works out these difficult issues, that these issues are still with us, and I would like to see if we can have some conversation about how what was started then can be looked at now, particularly in the light of education and the absolute need to have a quality public school education for all our children.
Thank you, Bob. As always, a perpetually thoughtful and yet at the same time kind of incandescent person. That's what you get from Moses. And of course, the movement did the same thing. He mentioned going upside of his head in Billy Jack Caston in Liberty, Mississippi in 1961. These were the first people who tried to register to vote, and they were brave enough to go with him. And before they even got to the courthouse, they were beaten in the street by the cousin of the sheriff, and then arrested. And then Bob said, "I want to press charges," which was unheard of for a black person beaten as a lesson not to try to register other black people to vote. Then say he wants to press charges, and they actually had a trial and had to kind of sneak him out of the county before he got lynched. But the first person that he called from jail when he got arrested was John Doerr in the Kennedy Justice Department. And so during this period when his witness is electrifying the civil rights movement and evaporating, as he put it, the distinction between voter registration and political action, Dr. King is also rising through direct action of his own, ultimately in Birmingham, where, to me, the shorthand of it is that it melted the country's resistance on all these issues of federalism only when small children, mostly girls, 8-10 years old, went to jail in front of the dogs and fire hoses on May 2nd. And this is happening at the same time that Bob's voter registration drive in Mississippi is growing larger and larger, and more volunteers are taking part in it. And the demonstrations that spread across the country out of Birmingham and also at the same time out of Mississippi are what frame the context for President Kennedy's speech on June 11th that Ted referred to, 1963, in which he proposed the Civil Rights Act. I'd like to look. We have a small section of that now, and have the screen come down. The remarkable thing about this from Martin Luther King's point of view, he had called on it, and the previous day's front page said, "We really want to see the president speak in moral terms." The most distinctive thing about the oratory of Martin Luther King, if you look at it, is that he generally put one foot in the patriotic documents of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the other in the Scriptures. We will win our freedom because the heritage of our nation and the eternal will of God are embodied in our echoing demands. One day the South will know that when these disinherited children of God sat down in lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream and for the most sacred values in our Judeo-Christian heritage. So we would always have a spiritual base and a political base. Kennedy made this speech, and it has that same sturdiness. You'll hear the phrase in here that King reacted to, and I think the country reacted to as well. So this is the speech on June 11th, 1963, that really was a historic commitment on the part of the United States government responding to the civil rights movement.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay?
We'd like to move now to your questions. If you have questions on any of the subjects or countless others, please approach one of the mics, and while you're doing that, I'd like to ask Ted for what you remember about the context of that speech.
June 11th was the day that George Wallace vowed to stand in the doorway of the University of Alabama, and through Attorney General Kennedy, Nick Katzenbach, our marshals and others, it had been prearranged that the Alabama National Guard would be federalized and his own National Guard would remove him from that doorway. And fortunately, that choreography all came about. And the Attorney General, the President, and I were watching all of this on television in the Oval Office. And when it did work out, the President turned around to me, sitting a little behind him, and said, "I think maybe we ought to make that speech tonight." That speech, meaning the civil rights, the President's first full-blown declaration on civil rights, which we had talked about for months and which Dr. King had been urging. I said, "Tonight?" And because of, usually his nationwide television addresses were at 7, and in fact he asked Pierre Salinger to reserve time on the networks at 7. And Attorney General said to me, "Oh, don't worry, we've got a lot of material over the Justice Department." I went down to my office, and fortunately, in addition to the material from the Justice Department, I did have some background in this subject, and John Kennedy had, as I indicated, spoken at least in limited fashion on the subject during the campaign. I started putting it all together. And I later heard that National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy had gone to a dinner party, and when everybody said, "Well, let's tune in for the President's speech," he said, "Oh, no, there won't be a speech tonight." When I left the White House, there still wasn't any speech. It was the first time in my years there that at about 20 minutes of 7, the President came down the hall and came into my office and said, "Where is it?" And I assured him that there was the third draft about to come out of my secretary's typewriter, and I was just finishing up the final pages, and he said, "Oh, I thought I was going to have to go on national television, extemporaneous." And on a few pieces of paper, maybe a back of an envelope, who knows, he had scrawled out some phrases, and if you read the whole speech with care, you'll notice there's a slight change in the rhythm at one point. Those are is scrawled phrases from his back of the envelope, probably the best part of the speech. In any event, it was the first time that any American president had declared that all forms of legally authorized or mandated, permitted segregation or discrimination on the basis of color would be thereafter banished in this country. Not only was he going to send legislation to that effect, but his executive orders would be to that effect, his government would act to that effect, and he wanted every citizen to act accordingly. And I might add, it was the use of the presidential pulpit at its best, because for weeks thereafter, he didn't just send the legislation up, which he did, and work hard for it, and Bobby worked very hard for it, as did Burke Marshall and others, but the president called to the White House almost every evening, first the leaders of American business, then the leaders of American labor, then the leaders of American education, then the clergymen, and one group after another of America's leaders, to tell them that this was their responsibility too, and he and the Attorney General educated them on their responsibilities.
Thank you. We have lots of questions I want to ask all of you in the line, because we want to try to get to all of them, to make your question half as long or less as you were planning. And we're going to go really quickly. But Harris, you told me that you heard what Martin Luther King's reaction was. He was watching that speech, and somebody told you what it was?
No, I told you.
Oh, Ted did, yeah.
Remind me again the name of the delegate.
Walter Fauntleroy.
Yes. I got a call several years ago from Walter Fauntleroy, whom many of you know. He was the longtime delegate for the District of Columbia to the Congress, and he was an aide and associate of Dr. King's. And he called to tell me, I'm not sure why, I had just come across something on paper, that he and Dr. King had watched that speech together. Now, bear in mind, King had been skeptical about Kennedy. He had been emphatic that Kennedy make the right kind of speech. They sat there in front of the television, and Walter Fauntleroy told me when the speech ended, breaks me up to tell you, Dr. King leaped to his feet and said, "Walter, that white man not only stood up at the plate, but he hit a home run."
All right, well. Sports is everywhere. We'll start on the right. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Teodoro Rosenson. You being the speechwriter for President John F. Kennedy, during the inauguration, presidential or the president's inauguration, he said these famous words: "It's not what the country can do for you, it's what you can do for the country." Did you have something to do with this speech, that you wrote this speech, and also how this changed the moment between African Americans and white people? Myself, being from Costa Rica, I got a change. Thank you.
I guess that's for me.
Yes, Teddy, ask if you had anything to do with that speech.
Yeah. Well, I've been giving the same answer for many years. Ask not. But if you're cleared for highly classified government secrets, come see me afterwards.
Yes,
I'll
sir.
Tell you. But I happen to agree with you that it did change the spirit in this country on a great many issues of that kind, including civil rights. Many people have told me that their group, whether it was students or whatever, were inspired by that speech to take action, that we now had a young president who wanted action, who was calling people to action. And although the speech did not specifically address the number of causes and so on, they felt he was speaking to them and they acted.
Ted, just one thing about that. Ted Sorensen and John Kennedy, they ring the same notes over years together. It's an extraordinary relationship. And that, whether you did that phrase or he did it on his own, it rings years of the best of John Kennedy, a great part of which you were working on. So it's something that should be part of the history books, this remarkable relationship between these two men.
Hi, I have a question to Mr. Sorensen. Do you think that President Kennedy was an effective party leader, considering that most of Kennedy administration's major policies were passed after his assassination?
Well, what you really mean is, was he an effective congressional leader?
Yes, sir.
Was he as good as Lyndon Johnson? Probably not. He didn't have the famous Johnson treatment of twisting arms and other parts of the anatomy. But considering the fact that the basic democratic program for aid to depressed areas, for strengthening Social Security, for raising the minimum wage, had all failed in the Congress between 58 and 1960, and the fact that Kennedy got them all through shows that even though, as I think I mentioned earlier, 20 Democratic seats were lost in the 1960 election. So even with that smaller edge, Kennedy was still, with the help of a terrific team led by Larry O'Brien, Kennedy was still able to get the bulk of that legislative program through, and the following year he got through his Trade Expansion Act, and we've seen recently how controversial trade can be in this country because people don't like imports, except when they're consumers, but workers don't like imports. So he wasn't as good as Johnson, but he had his ways of trying to get the Democrats in the House and Senate to agree with him, and on balance did better than history has usually written it.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Hi, for Mr. Moses, are your calls now for better public education any different than calls made in the 50s and 60s made by yourself and by Martin Luther King Jr. to desegregate? And if so, how are they different now? How are the calls for better education different now?
Yeah. The question about the question came up earlier when we were having lunch about the Brown decision and the impact of that. And one thing that Burke is saying here in his writings is that if you think about what the Supreme Court said in 1883, which set up the basis for Jim Crow, and said that, in effect, and this is this issue of federalism, that the federal government cannot really, Congress cannot really legislate about the civil rights of the freed slaves, that the public lives of people belong to the states, right? That this is the way our country is set up, the way the Constitution is set up. Supreme Court was saying back then that we are citizens of states as well as citizens of the national country. And as citizens of states, the states have the right to say what the public lives of people should be, right? And so that set up Jim Crow, which now is still in effect in the 60s when we come down there. Now what Burke is saying is that one way to think about Brown is to say that it reintroduces the federal responsibility for the individual lives of citizens. So it's not just the state which has the say about all their public lives, right? So, as you know, after Brown, the South and Mississippi set up ways to try to circumvent that integration, and then when they couldn't circumvent the actual law, went after the judges, right? And so we're in the middle of that, right? The issue of the appointment of Supreme Court judges is coming directly out of that, right? Because if you can't go out after the law, you need to go after the people who interpret the law, right? The judicial system. So the whole country is now embroiled in this question about how should our judicial system look and so forth. What struck me, and I was on the witness stand in the spring of 1963. We had taken hundreds of sharecroppers down to register to vote in Greenwood. SNCC workers had been arrested. Burke Marshall and Bobby Kennedy had had our cases removed to the federal courts, and we were in federal district court in Greenville. And the room was, the courtroom was packed wall to wall with sharecroppers, right? Standing room only. And the judge asks me, why are we taking illiterates down to register? And so we've thought about that question, and in essence, we answer, well, the country can't have its cake and eat it too. It can't have denied a whole people access to politics through their, I mean, access to education through the political arrangements, and then turn around and say, well, you can't access politics because you're illiterate. Right? Now, we won that struggle in terms of the Voting Rights Act and the move to not make literacy a part of it. But my point is that sharecropper education, what I've come to call sharecropper education, was the subtext of the right to vote. And what sharecropper education was established in this country after Reconstruction went under, and the idea that a whole people are only going to do a certain kind of work in this country, and so they only should get a certain kind of education. So my sense is that the Constitution of the United States doesn't say we the Supreme Court, it says we the people. So I think that this issue has to be taken to the people of this country, that we've got to go all across this country and raise the issue with the people of this country that what kind of constitution do they want vis-a-vis this critical issue of the quality of public school education for every child in the country. So we need to get beyond the Supreme Court. We need to put something on the books through the Congress, through all the states. I mean, the state of Mississippi, its constitution dates from 1890. Nobody has a right to an education in Mississippi because in 1890, the state of Mississippi was concerned with removing Negro presence in politics. In the last presidential election, the state of Alabama had on it a question about public school education. And in the state of Alabama, they voted not to change the state constitution, right? They voted to say that, and the state constitution of Alabama says the school should still be segregated, right? But they voted not to change. So what, are we just citizens of states vis-a-vis our education? I mean, if you think about what President Kennedy was grappling with and what the country was grappling with in the early 60s was that in that talk that we just said, he's talking about, well, is everybody going to be a citizen of the country, right, vis-a-vis certain basic rights? Well, we're not quite there yet, right? We're not quite there on the issue of publication. We are citizens of states. I mean, the Supreme Court in the 1983 Rodriguez case said that there is no federal right to an education, right? So you can't come to us asking for relief about funding of schools in Texas because basically they're saying you're a citizen of the state of Texas vis-a-vis your education. So is that what we really want in this country? Right? I think, well, maybe the answer is yes, but we ought to have that conversation. Right? We have never, as a country, allowed ourselves a conversation about what do we really mean about educating all the children in the country. Sorry for that long answer.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'm going to try. I don't know. I knew I'm trying to violate your rules. I'd like to do one very quick question to Bob Moses. I didn't know you weren't in the South. It was referred to earlier that you came down from the North, a graduate student. Where were you? What were you studying?
I was at Harvard studying philosophy in the 56 to 58. And I left and went to the Horace Mann School in New York to teach math, 7th and 8th grades, from 58 to 61. And so when the sit-ins hit in January of 1960, I was at Horace Mann, and my uncle was teaching at Hampton Institute, and I went down during the spring break to look at the students who were demonstrating from Hampton in Newport News. And Wyatt T. Walker came down from Petersburg, Virginia, to give the mass meeting. And he said they were going to open up an office for King in Harlem. And I started working in that office. Bayard Rustin was running that office. And I asked Bayard if he would arrange for me to go down to Atlanta in the summer of 60. And that's where I met Ella Baker. And Ella sent me over to Mississippi. And that's where I met Amzie Moore. And that's how I got involved.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Now, this next one is a little bit more thoughtful. You've had, at least on me, my age, the desired effect. I've been carried back to 1963, and I'm remembering June 10th and 11th. On one day, the Civil Rights speech, the next day, the American University speech about the test ban, and the feeling of hopefulness of that summer, something that never it came. Went. I was at the March on Washington. The feeling of the closeness of the races on that day blew up a short time later in the church bombing. But there was just a feeling that I imagine the younger people in the room cannot even imagine. Certainly from the perspective of 2005 and these last 5 years of horror show. But to what degree, I guess, what I'm thinking too, there's another element of this, of the continuity of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, whereas the general sense is that John was a more conservative man and Bobby was developing in public in a very unusual way. To what sense was there a unified notion? We're going for peace and civil rights. This unified, I mean, these great, great themes that we've not heard, obviously, we will never hear the end of them. To what degree was he consciously, you know, there was, I'm sorry to go on and on.
Sir, we've got
October,
4 minutes to do 4 more questions. So
okay.
Does anybody
All right, I'm sorry, I'll stop. But October, the sense of his being liberated from Berlin that hung over him, and now he's free to do peace and civil rights. Was that so?
Let me say that it seems to me we needed all three of the men you're celebrating to get as far as we did by that spring of high hopes in 63 when American University and then it came first, I think, and then the civil rights speech followed each other. It took all three to get us to the point where when the next panel takes over, the country was in the edge of the historic change to win the two great goals that King had focused on, the movement in those years of climax of the civil rights movement had focused on, ending publicly enforced segregation in all parts of American life and winning the right to vote. They were won before all three men were killed. But just imagine what if with Kennedy's cool political, John Kennedy's skill and intelligence, and Bob Kennedy's enormously developing and widening passion and commitment
and Martin Luther King had been with us in the 30 years since, when they were, King and Robert Kennedy had both called for climbing the next mountains after those were won in their last talks. And it's in these 30 years that have followed that we feel so painfully the loss of that combination, where public protests and public power finally met on those two issues.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank. Yes, ma'am.
Everything that I've learned about the civil rights movement, I was born in 1964, has been either through books, documentaries, or the forums that I've attended here. My question is more about your understanding of the move to the right of the country. My question is, how do you make sense, being on the forefront of the civil rights movement in your positions, about the religious leaders of the right and where they're taking the country and how they're influencing it?
Do you want to direct that to anybody in particular? Or?
I would like all of them to answer, but it doesn't matter.
Well, hello. I'd like to point your attention to when Ronald Reagan was nominated as the Republican candidate in 1980 for president. Trent Lott arranged for him to give his first speech in Philadelphia, Mississippi, at the Neshoba County Fair. And that, of course, was the place where the three civil rights workers were murdered. And Ronald Reagan sent a message to all of the racist white men across the South, right, that the Republican Party was now going to be in their corner, right? Now, he didn't need to say anything about race. All he needed to say was states' rights and be at that fair, right? And the country let him do it. The country let him get away with it. The New York Times, I'm talking about the Democratic Party, I'm talking about everybody. The whole country allowed him to do that, right? And that marked also what we are into today, that is the struggle about the justices, right? Because that was also the beginning of the struggle to see how we're going to, what kind of people we're going to appoint on the Supreme Court, right? So that's just one little piece of this, but you ought to check that out.
I would second that with a couple of small details. That Reagan gave off the era of geniality as though this just happened, that he was oblivious to this, and that was just the place he made his speech. There was ferocious infighting within the campaign about what this would mean. This was very conscious as to what the signal would send. It was connected to the overall message that government is the problem and that the central government is bad, which is the dominant idea in politics, which is just precisely the opposite idea of ask not what your country can do for you, public service. So there's a pretty big shift here in the ethos between public service, what can we do, let's grapple with these large questions and grapple with very fundamental questions, that Bob is talking about, and now where we have kind of symbolic spitball politics with the government being bad. So this has happened under our noses, and it's not that complicated. But I think what the movement is showing is that it's hard but not impossible to change the whole sense of hope and the whole sense of possibility in a country. It just takes a long time, and it starts with every citizen.
And they were all men of faith. They were not afraid to talk about being men of faith, but they were careful about the separation of church and state. I mean, John Kennedy was extremely careful about that issue because he was a groundbreaker. Mm-hmm. So specifically, my concern is that as Democrats, I think we need to talk more about being people of faith. That's just my feeling.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
A question for the whole panel and the audience, too, as far as that goes. You are all policymakers, activists, authors, et cetera, et cetera. It's always amazing that there's certain conversations we can't maintain, that about race relations or whatever else. We can talk about it for the moment, but it seems to drop. How can a country that claims to be the leader of the free world trying to export democracy every place else not pursue a constitutional amendment that an education should be a constitutional right? Just as how do we not continue the Equal Rights Amendment pursuit? I mean, stop and think about it. In this so-called democratic society, it is amazing to me that we allow something like that to last, because even though it would be the federal government framing it, it takes 38 states to ratify it, which would mean that the whole country would have to get into it. Why can't we manifest and maintain this kind of discussion, recognizing what's happening in our public schools right now, in that it's rendering us from being competitive in the world order, from an industrial standpoint or whatever else? And why can't we put our commitments to it to make sure that all of our youngsters, our next generations, have access to a public education?
Ted, go.
Why, both questions really boil down to why have organized politics and organized religion in this country moved so far from to the right? They have moved to the right. When I was a young man involved in both the civil rights and peace movements, the churches were our main allies. They worked strongly with us on civil rights and on peace. But you're right. It's all changed now. Now, one of the reasons organized politics has moved to the right is what we've been talking about. Lyndon Johnson said when he signed the Kennedy Civil Rights Bill, and with more amendments that he had strengthened it with in 1964, this is the death knell of the Democratic Party. Since then, the Democratic, I don't want to turn this into a partisan rally, but since then, the Democratic Party has lost 7 out of the 10 presidential elections because we have lost almost all of the southern and border states ever since the Kennedy-Johnson civil rights steps. It was an act of political courage, but they knew it was the right thing to do. Hopefully, we'll get some other people in office in the future who will want to do the right thing.
Another point on that is that John Kennedy was careful not to invoke religion for obvious reasons of his own experience in winning the election. He had to show that he was not going to take orders from the Vatican. He did go to the scriptures and the Constitution in the great civil rights speech. Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, I think throughout their lives, put issues in the terms that respond and echo with their faith and draw on their faith. And as Ted said, that was true of a large part of organized religion, not all of it at all, of course, but if you want from these men clues of what needs to be done on all the issues we've talked about, including Bob's, Moses' great service in making us think of whether it's a Constitution amendment or otherwise, we can really see that quality education is available to all. The clues would, to me, I think, be if you want gay rights to be established fully, and people that go for it and sign bills or vote, they have the same moment that Lyndon Johnson did when he said, oh, we're losing the South the next elections by signing this civil rights bill. But it seems to me how you tap the religious force of America for the common good in an affirmative form of action instead of the negative forces that religion is mustering is the challenge for a political leader today. And Robert Kennedy, by the time he was killed, was putting most of the issues in terms not only of the practical points that were so powerful, but of the spiritual points that he reflected and by then was embodying.
I'd just like to make one small point in reaction to this. Politics was, the whole structure of partisan politics in the United States was changed by this period. There was no Republican Party in the South. I grew up then in Atlanta. Republicans were scarce as polar bears in the South. Republicans were Yankees. There were a few judges and the old black and tan black Republicans. That's all there were. And Johnson was right, saying, he told Bill Moyers, we are giving the South to the Republicans for my lifetime and yours. That doesn't mean forever. What's changed in the South since this whole 40-year changed. The leadership of the new National Republican Party came out of a Southern Republican Party that didn't even exist until Barry Goldwater voted against the Civil Rights Act in 1964. They have, over a time, created a presumption that if you're a white person in the South, you're going to vote Republican, especially if you're a married white Protestant. You're going to vote Republican. What's new in the South is that there's party competition and that Democrats are trying to learn slowly how to put together coalition politics. That's what's new. And in the long run, that's a hopeful sign, and in the long run, I believe they'll learn to win elections. So, but they have to do the same thing. So thank you very much. We were given 15 minutes dispensation by Mr. Shattuck, and that 15 minutes is up.
I think we want to thank our wonderful panel, the first panel here, Ted Sorensen, Harris Wofford, Bob Moses, Taylor Brandt. We will now take it.